course. And also, for anyone taking notes, plans to take notes, and you're more than welcome to have a copy of the PDF after the talk, so that saves you the writing stuff, all the better. So, before I give an outline of what I'll be talking about today and the course itself, I thought, by means of an appetizer, I'd just answer the question in the most general sense, what is exactly a normalization group? And it really all comes down to physics at different scales, and the very everyday observation that the way we describe physics, of course, changes with scales, and this is no more complicated than saying that the universe looks different depending on whether you look at it through a microscope or through a telescope. A more Wilsonian way of saying this might be that the relevant degrees of freedom change with the scale. And of course, there's a few microscopic laws which give rise to the rich macroscopic behavior that we see around us. So the ERG, the exact renormalization group, is something which takes us from this microscopic description to the macroscopic one. And I suppose that we understand what's going on at small scales. If we have a link between these small scales and the larger ones, then perhaps we can understand what's going on at the large scales. And of course, whether or not one can really do this in practice depends on the physics of the situation and whether there's any approximations one can implement that both respect the physics and can be applied to the exact RG. But the ERG is this link which takes us from small to large. So here's a very brief outline of the course. So what I'll be talking about today is Wilson's picture of renormalization. And I'll be relating to this exact renormalization group, but I'm not actually going to have to explicitly write down any exact RG equations to do so. So I'll rectify that in the second lecture when I'll give some specific examples and show how to do some simple calculations. One of the particular strengths of the exact RG is that one can perform calculations when there's no small parameter available. There are some robust and fairly reliable approximation schemes. One in particular is a derivative expansion, which I'll talk about in the third lecture. And finally, I'll conclude the talk with saying how to implement the exact RG in gauge theories. So at the beginning of each lecture, I thought I'd provide a sort of a list of the literature. This is by no means comprehensive, but just a list of the ones that I personally have found useful. So the four up here all are oriented towards the statistical physics side of things. And in particular, this textbook down here by Cardi is a very nice introduction to the subject. However, the bulk of the course will be focusing on quantum field theory, and I particularly like these three papers. So this one by Tim Morris is actually quite a short paper, but it's really very deep. There's a lot of extremely useful information in that. And it's very nicely complemented by this review by Bagnall and Bevilliers. So I wouldn't say there's anything deeper in this paper than this one, but this one takes a somewhat broader approach to the subject. And so these two go very well together. This one also has an excellent review of the literature. Finally, this one by Vetterich et al. This was what inspired my little picture at the beginning about what the exact RG is. And they've got a very nice analogy for describing exact RG as a microscope of varying resolving power. Actually, in his book, Cardi says that one can achieve a similar effect if you're myopic like myself by just taking your glasses off and putting them back on. So an outline of this particular lecture. So first of all, I'll just outline the very broad uses of the exact RG in physics. Then I'll discuss some qualitative aspects. I'll go through the basic ideas of what the framework really is, talk about relevance, irrelevance, and all that. Then the real heart of the talk will be about renormalizability, and in particular, what it is for a quantum field theory to be non-perturbatively renormalizable. And finally, I'll recap. So there's really two main uses. These aren't the exclusive uses, but two main uses of the ERG, one in statistical physics and the other in quantum field theory. So one can understand its use in statistical physics, I think, best by example. And so just take a uniaxial ferromagnet. So I'll introduce the temperature, T, magnetization, M, and external magnetic field, H. And here's the phase diagram. So of course, as we lower the temperature here, from the disordered phase, we reach this ordered phase here. There's a phase transition at the critical temperature. And here's a plot of the magnetization again. So we lower the temperature. At the critical temperature, we then start to achieve non-zero magnetization. And what the exact RG allows us to do is it allows us to understand the phenomena in the region of these phase transitions. So in particular, we can compute critical exponents, an example of which in the region here, the magnetization depends on the critical temperature minus the temperature to some power. This power is called a critical exponent. The exact RG allows one to compute those. And it also gives an understanding, this is something I'll discuss in this talk, of universality. And that's the case with very different systems. So for example, the uniaxial ferromagnet I'm discussing and water at the liquid vapor transition have the same critical exponents despite seeming to be physically very different systems. So most of the course will focus on quantum field theory, and this is what the ExactRG is useful for in this context. So qualitatively, and this is really what I'll be focusing on, as I said, towards the second half of this talk, it gives an understanding of the physical basis of renormalization. And this is through asymptotic freedom, asymptotic safety, and triviality, which are three things I'll discuss in detail later. And another thing that I'll talk about is why perturbative renormalizability of a theory by no means implies non-perturbative renormalizability. It's quite nice to be able to see how this comes about. Quantitatively, one can use the ERG to search for non-perturbatively renormalizable theories even when there's no small parameter available, and there's some robust and reliable ways of doing this. Once one's found these renormalizable theories, a particularly nice feature is that one can then perform calculations directly in terms of renormalized variables. There's no need to implement this overall cutoff, put in your counterterms, tune things such that you end up with a renormalizable theory. And really combining these two things here, the ERG admits non-perturbative approximation schemes, which actually preserve renormalizability. And this is not necessarily a trivial thing to do in quantum field theory, but within the ExactRG, it's almost automatic. So those are the broad uses of the ERG. Now, as I said at the beginning in my very brief introduction, the idea is that it's taking you from a microscopic picture to a macroscopic picture. How does it actually achieve this? And it's useful to stay in the realm of statistical physics just for the time being to introduce the concept of blocking. So here you can consider a lattice of spins. So there we go, there's a lattice of spins, which I'm going to take to just be pointing up or down. And to go from microscopic to macroscopic, what we're going to do is going to average over groups of spins. So, for example, let's suppose that I decide to group them into blocks of four, and I can see that there's three pointing up in this block and one pointing down, so it makes sense to replace that with a macroscopic up spin. I go along to the next block. Now, you see, in this case, I've actually got two pointing down and two pointing up. The question is, what do I do next? Well, I could resolve this by choosing 3x3 blocks or blocks shaped like a plus, or I could keep this block and choose some prescription like flipping a coin. The point is, and this will be important, particularly in the second lecture, is it really doesn't matter what I do. There's a lot of freedom in the ExactRG, and that can actually be turned to one's advantage. You can exploit the freedom in the way in which you block. So anyway, I flipped my coin and came up with this. And then you can do that for all the other spins. Now, the final part of the ExactRG transformation is rescaling. So what I want to do is I want to reduce the lattice spacing, which you can see has now doubled compared to the previous one. I want to reduce it down to the same as it was. Oops. This has more buttons than I realized before. So I've rescaled that, and this patch corresponds to this one here. So I'm imagining the system was infinite in size, or at least bigger than I showed, and I've just contracted it back down as follows. And what the ExactRG does is it implements the continuous version of this blocking. So where I've got an infinitesimal blocking parameter rather than doubling or rather halving the lattice spacing and so forth. So I've introduced this blocking procedure, and an obvious question to ask is, what are the effects of this? And suppose that to start with, I set my model up such that the microscopic spins were interacting only with their nearest neighbors. Then what happens is that the block spins will generically exhibit all possible interactions. And each time we block, the strength of these various interactions will change. So there's a very convenient way that we can visualize this. And this is as a flow in parameter space. So you can consider the space of all possible interactions. I might have the nearest neighbor, strength of the nearest neighbor interaction along this axis, strength of the next nearest neighbor interaction along this axis, and so forth. And each point in the space then represents, of course, the strength of the various different couplings. And as we block and rescale, we're going to hop around in this space. And a very important thing that will be really crucial for everything that follows in this talk is that this transformation of blocking and then rescaling can have fixed points. And so here's a picture of the kind of thing that we're talking about. So here is one of those fixed points there. I've defined this surface here. This is called the critical surface, and this is defined such that any trajectory on the critical surface is flowing in to the fixed point. These arrows here are supposed to indicate that this black trajectory is just slightly off the critical surface. So the critical manifold is spanned by the so-called irrelevant operators, and I'll come back to precisely what those are a little later in the talk. And one can leave the critical manifold along the relevant directions. So Card has got, I mean, it's a nice little bit in his book about if you're an experimentalist, you've got n relevant directions, and you want to be on the critical surface. So if you've got a sample of a ferromagnet and you want it to undergo a phase transition, you've got n dials, if you like, you've got to tune the temperature magnetic field. You've got n relevant directions, there's n of these dials that need tuning to bring your theory, which might be somewhere here, onto the critical surface. So already, just with this qualitative picture, it's possible to discuss universality and where this comes from. So as I said, all theories on the critical surface flow towards the fixed point. So the IR dynamics of these theories are the same, because if you think what we're doing with this blocking, we're going from our UV short distance picture to our IR infrared macroscopic picture. And so it doesn't matter where we start on this, if we do enough RG steps to take us into the regime of the fixed point, the IR dynamics are the same. And it's the statement of this is that theories are said to be in the same universality class. So to determine the critical exponents, we need to move slightly away from the critical surface. So remember that they have this form Tc minus T. So you need to move a little bit away, for example, from the critical temperature. But the IR behavior is still determined by the fixed point. So here's my flow that's on the critical surface. You can see I move just slightly away. It's going to pretty much follow this trajectory before shooting off in the relevant direction. And so the IR behavior is still determined by the same fixed point. So the critical exponents, as we'll see later, are just obtained by linearizing around the fixed point, and they're universal. So we're now going to introduce the Wilsonian effect of action, which starts to make some of these ideas more quantitative. And the starting point is the partition function. And I've tagged explicitly a bare scale here. So this is my large momentum cutoff. So it's my short distance scale. And the modes above the scale are all cut off or regularized. And this is the bare, or the classical action. So what I'm doing is I'm starting off at my bare scale here, and I'm integrating out between this scale and a much lower effective scale. And the point is I want to do this procedure such that the partition function changes, stays the same. So the partition function is the thing that's encoding my physics. I don't want my physics to change under this procedure. But the effects of the high momentum modes must be taken into account. So I've integrated them out. If I'm still describing the same system, their effects have to be encoded somewhere. They can't just be got rid of. And what happens is that the action evolves. So my bare action here has been replaced by this Wilsonian effective action. And this is just the same statement as saying that all my various parameters are changing as I do my RG procedure. And the changes are encoded in the Wilsonian effective action. So I said I wasn't going to write down any explicit exact RG equations, but I will at least give a flavor for how they're derived. And the starting point is this equation here. And at this point out what everything is and then say why this is the starting point. So here I've got my effective scale, lambda. Phi is just some set of fields. And S is my Wilsonian effective action. Now, the point of writing in this form is I've got this total derivative here. And so if I now integrate with respect to d phi on both sides, and what I've got on this side is lambda of the partition function. I've got this is just flowing into the integral of the total derivative, which is zero. So this is building in from the very beginning the fact that under this blocking procedure, I want my partition function to stay the same. This psi, which I'll discuss in much greater detail in the next lecture, this defines our precise exact renormalization group. As I said, there's a lot of freedom in what we choose. And this parameterizes the blocking procedure. And there's a huge freedom in the precise form. We can adapt it to suit our needs, and we'll see that in particular in the fourth lecture in the case of gauge theory. So my flow equation, then, I can just expand this out. And I get this following form, but this isn't going to be important for the point of view of this lecture. So the things that I wrote down on the previous transparency, this included the blocking functional. And I said that there are two parts to the exact RG transformation. First of all, I want to average over groups of spins, and then I rescale everything back down to the same size as before. So as I said, there's two ingredients, blocking and rescaling. And rescaling is actually very simple to implement. What one can do is one can just measure all dimensional quantities in units of lambda, the effective cutoff. But we have to remember to take account of any anomalous dimensions, so this isn't just a classical analysis. So I would rescale dimensionful x to x times lambda to the full scaling dimension. And I can replace minus lambda to lambda with just dt. And t is often called the RG time. So this is something which is increasing as we go along the RG flow. And really all I need for the rest of this talk is that the RG equation just has this general form, the flow of S, some function here of S, and that fixed points correspond to dt of S equals zero. So we're now going to discuss the linearized ERG theory. So this is where we linearize the flow equation in the vicinity of fixed points, and this will allow us to compute critical exponents and so forth. So as I said, that at a fixed point we have this. And near a fixed point, what we can do is we can separate the ERG operator into this linear part here and this quadratic part. When I analyze this equation, of course, dt of f star is zero by definition. So if I now just focus on the linear part, which of course contains this term here and this term here, it turns out I can separate variables. And what I've got here, I've got these integration constants. These lambda are my scaling exponents. And these are called the eigenperturbations here. So you can see if I substitute this back into here at the linear level, then what I get is that these just satisfy this eigenvalue equation. Now, as I've written things down here, there's no reason to suspect that these lambda I are quantized, but we know in practice that they are. So these lambda I, they're basically telling you which ones the relevant directions are and which ones the irrelevant directions are. We know typically there's a finite number of relevant directions and so forth. I'm not going to discuss how they're quantized in this lecture, but I will come back to this in the third lecture of the course. And so finally, I can write my action at some effective scale as the fixed point action plus the effects of the flows in its vicinity. So what are the relevant operators and the irrelevant operators? So let me just write this up again here. So there's actually two classes of operators. There's ones which have physical eigenvalues, and I'll discuss those first. These correspond to the so-called scaling operators. So if the scaling exponent lambda is greater than zero, then we call the corresponding operator relevant. You can see that if lambda is greater than zero, then as the RG time increases, this is just going to grow, hence relevant, because it's increasing in value. Conversely, if lambda I is less than zero, then the operator is irrelevant. As the RG time increases, the value of the operator decreases. If lambda I is precisely zero, then the OI is called marginal. Now, at the level, at the linear level, we then see that the fixed point plus anything in the marginal direction is also a fixed point. But once we go to beyond leading order, this property might not hold anymore. And of course, that's the case, for example, just in B equals 4 scalar field theory, where you know small a. Oh, sorry, a is just some constant. So in D equals 4 scalar field theory, what you find is that the four-point coupling, and it's in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point, so one can just do power counting, it's marginal at linear order, but beyond linear order, it's irrelevant. So these are the classification of the physical eigenvalues and the physical operators. But there's also some unphysical eigenvalues, and these correspond to so-called redundant operators. And these are associated with invariances of the exact ERG equation. So there's a lot of freedom in how one sets up your ERG equation, and there's some invariances associated with this. So physics is independent of these. This is just how you're defining your non-universal details. And I'll come back to this in lecture 3. For the rest of this talk, I'm just going to focus on these physical ones. So we're now in a position to discuss renormalizability of quantum field theory from a non-perturbative point of view. So, of course, there are UV divergences in generic quantum field theory, as I'm sure everyone in this room knows. So a diagram like this in four-dimensional scalar field theory will exhibit a logarithmic divergence. Now, if all the divergences can be absorbed into a finite number of couplings, then we're going to say that the theory is renormalizable. But we really want to do this beyond perturbation theory. And as I said at the beginning of the talk, perturbative renormalizability is by no means a guarantee of non-perturbative renormalizability. This is the case in four-dimensional scalar field theory. I'll discuss precisely how that comes about shortly. And I've been talking about how the exact RG has this, you know, overall cutoff. We're integrating out degrees of freedom between the overall cutoff and some lower effective scale. But this built-in cutoff, it provides a very natural tool to study these issues here. So I'm now going to go on to discuss continuum limits, which is the first part of renormalization theory in this context. So the question I want to ask is, are there any effective actions which depend on my effective scale and my bare scale, which I can safely send the bare scale to infinity? Well, immediately, the exact RG provides one very simple answer about how to do this. So remember that we've rescaled all quantities using our effective scale lambda, so that now only dimensionless variables appear. Now, fixed points of the ERG immediately in this language will correspond to continuum limits. here's my fixed point equation. Because I've rescaled, S star must be independent of all scales now, including lambda zero. So if it's independent of lambda zero, then trivially we can send lambda zero to infinity. So these things here are conformal field theories. There's no scale. Obviously, we can send the bare scale to infinity. And so immediately then, one finds in the ERG that fixed point theories correspond to the simplest types of continuum limits. So what about more elaborate continuum limits? So the ones that I just talked about are sort of a scale independent, but we know, of course, that there are scale dependent continuum limits. So how do we find those? So the nice thing is we can come back to this picture, which I first introduced in the context of statistical physics. So what I want to do is I want to consider this trajectory here, this one which is almost hitting the fixed point, but not quite. And what I want to do is I want to do a few things. So on the one hand, I want to send lambda zero to infinity. But as I do this procedure, I want to tune this theory closer and closer to the critical surface. And oops, and then along the resultant trajectory here, I'm going to re-express things in terms of renormalized quantities. So as I do this tuning procedure, we can see that the trajectory splits into two. There's this part here, which is just sinking into the fixed point and isn't going to concern us much more. And there's this part which emanates out, Wilson's so-called renormalized trajectory. And of course, the clue is in the name, and it turns out that the actions along this renormalized trajectory are, of course, renormalizable. And it's very easy to see why. So I'll discuss these in more detail, so I'll just reproduce the picture up here for reference. So I'm going to do my linearization of the ERG about the fixed point. And what I want to do is I want to apply boundary conditions such that the flow sinks back into the fixed point as lambda tends to infinity. So I'm going to consider this trajectory here, and I want lambda equals infinity to be the fixed point here. I'm flowing to smaller values of lambda along the flow. Lambda tends to infinity is the same as the RG time going to minus infinity. So I'm temporarily just going to ignore any marginally relevant operators, and I'm going to write the boundary condition for my flow as this. So you can see that here's the fixed point action, and basically I'm going to arrange, I'm going to choose this part here, such as in the limit t tends to minus infinity, it vanishes. And you can see that the way that I'm going to do that is by taking the lambda I to be positive, so that these guys now are just the relevant operators. And this will suffice, really, to describe the qualitative picture of what's going on. If there are marginal operators in the theory as well, then I need to include these here, rather than going in, so this is going in as a power of lambda. These guys, the marginal ones, will go in, sink in logarithmically with lambda. So I've just actually written everything out in terms of lambda in this slide, so I'll just reproduce what I had before. So remember that these alpha I, these are our just integration constants. And what you can see is that the effective action at any scale is just going to be a function of the scale and of these integration constants. So this is the first step. So what I want to do now is I want to identify the various different couplings that I have in my theory, and I do this by applying the correct renormalization conditions. And the natural renormalization condition is just to identify G, the coupling, with this thing sitting in front of the operator. It's almost trivial. This is just a completely natural thing to do. If you've got a phi to the 4 operator, you want to call lambda the coupling that sits in front of it. That's all that this statement is. So I've just said that explicitly here. And so what this says is that if you've got the form of this action, you can just read off the couplings directly from its 4. If you want to know the coupling of the phi to the 6 term, you just look at the phi to the 6 term, see what the dependence in front of it is, and that's what you're going to call your coupling. And you can determine the anomalous dimension by choosing the normalization of the kinetic term just in the usual manner. Now the point is that these functions, these couplings G and the anomalous dimension, contain precisely the same information as the lambda and the alpha. So given these functions and a value of them, we can find lambda, this would be dimensional transmutation in the case that they're dimensionless, and we can just compute the alpha I essentially by inverting this equation. So the point of this is that we can trade lambda and alpha I for the couplings and the anomalous dimension. And so finally, we can write the action down in this form. And this is so-called self-similar. And as I'll discuss in a moment, this is where renormalizability directly follows. So here's just writing this out again. And the point is that the coupling depends on the scale only through the couplings and the anomalous dimension. There's no explicit dependence anywhere in here. And in particular, there's no explicit dependence on the bare scale over the effective scale. And this actually is a statement of renormalizability, a non-perturbative statement of it at that. So what the exact RG gives us then is it gives us a recipe for how to construct renormalizable theories. So first of all, what we want to do is transfer to dimensionless quantities using our effective scale. We then find a fixed point using the exact renormalization group, then construct a flow out of this fixed point, which in the neighborhood of the fixed point is just along the relevant and the marginally relevant directions. And this is our recipe for how to do this. So time for some examples. So we'll start with scalar field theory in four dimensions. So if we look at this in a non-perturbative manner, well, first of all, the only fixed point that's known to exist is the Gaussian one. It's generally thought that there aren't any other fixed points, and I'll assume that this is to be the case. And it turns out that the mass is the only relevant direction out of this fixed point. So the four-point coupling, as I mentioned earlier in the talk, is marginal at linear order, but beyond that, it's irrelevant. Everything else is irrelevant, and so if we want to construct some renormalized trajectory out of this fixed point, the only way we can do it is using the mass direction. And so non-perturbatively, the only renormalizable scalar field theories in four dimensions are trivial. But of course, perturbatively, things are very different. And you know, one of the first things that one learns in quantum field theory is that lambda 5 to 4 is a renormalizable theory. So how do these two things agree with each other? Well, order-by-order in perturbation theory, it is true that lambda 5 to 4 is renormalizable. And you can write the bare coupling here, some function of the renormalized coupling, plus this function here of the renormalized scale over the bare scale. Formally, I can just take the limit that the bare scale goes to infinity. This term vanishes, and so I've got renormalizability. I've got my self-similarity back here. There's only dependence on the renormalized coupling. All explicit dependence on lambda over lambda zero has disappeared. But this step is only a formal one, and you can, in fact, can't take it rigorously because the remaining perturbative series is ambiguous, and this is a consequence of ultraviolet renormalons. Now, I've actually got some extra slides on renormalons, which maybe I'll come back to at the end, because it's a little bit out of the direction of the main subject matter. But if there's questions on this, I can come back to it. Okay. Well, I can do this. I can do this now. In that case, as there is a question, I've got the time. So this is taken from Benike's review on renormalons. And suppose that we've got some divergent series as follows, where alpha is our coupling. So divergent series, of course, can be useful nevertheless if they're asymptotic to this function R in some region of complex plane. And then what we have is there are some numbers like this, such that if we take the divergent series up to a certain number here and look at the difference between this and the actual function, this is less than order alpha to the n plus 1. These things here can diverge with it. The point is, for asymptotic series, what happens is that the truncation error decreases at first, but then, of course, it starts to increase. So there's some irreducible error from this procedure. And if this happens, if this truncation error starts to increase only after a very large number of terms, then it's actually exponentially small. But suppose that you want to improve on this. Suppose that you're not happy. You won't really want to try and compute this more exactly and get rid of this error. Well, to improve the approximation, what you have to do is you have to try and resum the series. And I can define the Borel transform, the Borel transform as follows. So here's my original series. There's an extra factor of alpha, power of alpha, at each order here, which is included for convenience. The Borel transform is defined as follows. So I take the same coefficient R here. I introduce this new parameter T, which is now, if you like, playing the role of alpha, divided by n factorial. The point, the reason why this is useful is that from this transform, one can hope to reconstruct R. So it's a reasonably simple matter to check that if you just perform this integral, the Borel transform, you get back the series expansion here. Now the point is that if this Borel transform has no singularities, positive real T, and dies off fast enough, then you can perform this integral. However, if there are singularities along this domain of integration, then you can't perform the integral. And this is the problem of ultraviolet renormalons. So this is what I said about the ambiguity. So let me just mention So strictly, renormalons refer to singularities in the Borel plane, which come from a very particular physical process. But I'm just going to use a slightly looser definition here. I'm just going to use renormalons to refer to any singularity in this transform here. And if I have singularities along the positive real axis, then the ambiguity comes about because I don't know whether I should go above, deform my contour above the poles or below the poles. And so this is the ambiguity of perturbations theory.
What does use R? Which exponential is at rest?
Think of it as adding new terms.
Because the way that you
no, I'd say it's a reorganization. So it's a reorganization of the series. In the case that you've got renormal on singularities, this is precisely when there are exponentially small terms of a physical origin, in this case, that just aren't included in this description. In other words, if you want to reconstruct the theory, perturbation theory, in this case, is just not enough. So if you've got your full theory, you've got perturbation theory on the one hand, if you like, you've got the exponentially small corrections, together they make sense and there's no ambiguity. If you've just got perturbation theory, which is non-Borel resummable, then you're always going to be missing those exponentially small corrections in that case. That's where the ambiguity comes from. In the case that it is Borel resummable, in the case that it is Borel resummable, it's a subtle issue, I suppose, because just because you've got perturbation series, suppose that you've got some perturbation series, and suppose that you can Borel resum it to reproduce this function R, that doesn't necessarily mean that R corresponds to this, because I could always have added exponentially small contributions anyway. So there's a sort of a hierarchy of things here. On the one hand, you've got perturbation series which isn't Borel resummable, because there's ambiguities. On the other hand, you've got a perturbation series which is Borel resummable, which is great, but it doesn't necessarily correspond entirely to the original function. You need some additional physical input to determine whether that's the case. But, sorry.
Oh, sir, did I interrupt you?
No, it's not
good. So, does it mean that if it's, we have to consider that marginal operator will not remain marginal on a regime?
So when you've got a marginal operator, you determine relevance, irrelevance, and marginality by linearizing the exact RG transformation. So suppose that you find something which is marginal at linear order. Beyond linear order, it may or may not be. So an example where it is still monotone is if you just take n equals 4 super Yang Mills, where you've got your coupling, and it's conformal for all values of the coupling. So this is always marginal, right? Okay. But if you take scalar field theory of four dimensions, lambda is marginal at linear order, marginally irrelevant beyond linear order, and QCD is the other way around. It's marginal at linear order, but then it's marginally relevant.
So if you take that into account, this can be derivative or not?
This is really independent of those considerations. So all I'm asking in this situation is, I've got some perturbation series, right? Does the perturbation series make sense on its own or not? So that's the issue in this case. The reason that it came up was because, the reason it came up is, again, if you go back to scalar field theory of four dimensions, you find that the only relevant coupling is the mass. So that the only renormalizable trajectory is the mass trivial trajectory, which destroys the board. So you've got your fixed point here. The only renormalizable trajectory coming up here is massive and trivial. There's no interactions. Lambda is one of the irrelevant directions, but it sinks in very slowly. So this is the lambda direction. So it's irrelevant, it's sinking into this. Right? The question of Borel resummability then comes about because, well, perturbatively, it seems that I can construct a renormalizable trajectory along here because I have self-similarity. So you know how I wanted to write lambda there for some function of lambda renormalization plus these terms, which I said I could get rid of. So if I could really get rid of these terms here, and I've got something which is self-similar, if I've got something which is self-similar, and that's renormalizable, right? The point is you can't get rid of these terms because it's a formal limit. The remaining series here is ambiguous as a consequence of these renormalons. Is that clearer?
Sorry, is this renormal on the Landau?
So renormalons are actually often erroneously equated with a Landau pole, and there is a difference between them. So renormalon contributions, as I said, I've been using renormalons to describe any singularity in the Borel plane, but the strict definition of renormalons, they come from particular parts of the Feynman diagrams. They're related to the large momentum and small momentum behavior of these diagrams. Now, the renormalon pole shows up at one loop. Yeah, that's right, it shows up at one loop. And it's not disturbed by higher order order corrections. So you deduce the existence of the renormalon pole at that level. The existence of the Landau pole, on the other hand, is in principle a non-perturbative question, because sure, it shows up at one loop, but it could be removed from the second loop or the third loop, or perhaps it could be removed by non-perturbative considerations. So there's a delineation between the two concepts, but they are often confused.
To what is n equal to 4, so we angle Borel sum of them?
The comment I was making about n equals 4 is that was an example of an absolutely marginal operator versus a marginally relevant or a marginally irrelevant operator. So you can take any value for the coupling, the theory is still conformal. Right? Whereas in scalar field theory in 4 dimensions, you know, lambda 5 to 4, it doesn't float only at linear order. As soon as you increase the addition correction, it is floating. You can't property that a fixed point plus the marginal direction is still a fixed point is destroyed beyond linear order.
Are there any useful quantum field theories which are Borel sum of them?
The Borel sum ball. I don't know, but actually I've got, there is a quantity which surprisingly can be Borel sum that I'll just discuss very shortly. So I think I've talked about this already. So in fact, something I don't prove for the exact RG is that if one looks at QED within a very particular type of exact RG which corresponds to a very particular type of definition of the coupling, then the beta function is actually Borel resummable. Now it doesn't mean that the theory is Borel resummable, because you've still got the anomalous dimension and every other coupling in the theory. There's no reason to suspect that those are. But the beta function nevertheless is, which is quite unexpected, I'd say. But I don't have any useful quantum field theories that are entirely Borel resummable. Right. So I think that answered the question. So that was the case in 4 dimensions. So just to recap, we concluded that there were no non-perturbatively interesting renormalized trajectories. The situation is very different in 3 dimensions. So first of all, you have the Gaussian fixed point. And just as in the 4-dimensional case, you've got a mass term which is relevant. But here the 4-point coupling is relevant as well. The 6-point coupling is marginally irrelevant, as it turns out. But just using this one here, the 4-point one, you can construct now non-trivial interacting renormalizable theories along this lambda 5 to 4 direction. So this is one aspect in which 3-dimensional scalar field theory is richer, but there's a second aspect as well. There's another fixed point, so this is a non-trivial fixed point, of course, the famous Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So the Wilson-Fischer fixed point itself actually possesses a relevant direction, and one can use this to construct an RT renormalized trajectory. And so here's an example of the flow that one might have in scalar field theory in 3 dimensions. So you start off at the Gaussian fixed point here. You've got a flow along the lambda 5 to 4 direction here. And if you tune it right, you could end up at the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. So what you see is your ultraviolet behavior is determined by one fixed point. Your infrared behavior is determined by another. And this all relates, in fact, to the ideas of asymptotic safety, asymptotic freedom, and triviality in the following way. So triviality, first of all, so I think we've already discussed this to death by now, so here's a Gaussian fixed point, no interesting relevant direction, if you just get a mass of trivial theory. Asymptotic freedom, here the Gaussian fixed point has relevant interacting directions, and so you can use this trajectory to construct an interacting renormalizable theory. Now, in both cases, it's the Gaussian fixed point. Now, asymptotic safety is a completely different scenario. So I've got some non-trivial fixed point up here, and I've got some fixed point down here, which can be the Gaussian, but needn't be. Now, if I look at the theory in the infrared, let's suppose that this is what I know about, then the theory appears to be non-renormalizable, certainly not sitting on a renormalized trajectory out of this fixed point. But if I'm able to build back, if you like, up into the ultraviolet, then I'll be able to see that this theory is actually emanating originally from a non-perturbative fixed point. And the renormalizability of this trajectory, well, let me just start again. The physics in the infrared is determined by this fixed point, but the ultimate question as to whether it's renormalizable or not is determined in the ultraviolet. And this is what's been discussed quite a little bit at the moment in the literature. Martin Reuter, for example, has been doing studies in quantum gravity, trying to find just such a phenomenon where you find some theory in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point which appears to be non-renormalizable. If you can show that it's actually coming from a flow from some other fixed point, then you have asymptotic safety. So I wanted to conclude with what I called in my outline of the talk some sources of confusion. Well, these are things which have in any way confused me at one point or another, so I think they can be quite instructive to understand the subject better. So first of all, the question I want to ask is, what actually is the Bayer action? And one needs to be a little bit careful about how one thinks of this, and you should think of it in different ways depending on whether you're on an RT or a non-renormalizable trajectory. So if you're on a renormalized trajectory, you start from a fixed point. You choose integration constants associated with your relevant directions, which you're flowing out along, and you solve the action at all other scales. And just a note, some lattice terminology, the actions along a renormalized trajectory are sometimes called perfect actions. Now, you can talk about the Bayer action if you want to, and what it's sometimes referred to is the perfect action in the vicinity of the ultraviolet fixed point. But as I'll show on the next transparency a bit more clearly, Bayer action is something you're solving for, it's not something you're choosing and then flowing from. Your boundary condition is that you start from a fixed point, you choose your integration constants. A non-renormalizable trajectory, it's completely different. Here you just choose a boundary at the bare scale, and you solve for the action at lower scales. So you can see this on this picture here. So here's my renormalized trajectory, here's my fixed point. The trajectory is completely determined by my choice of fixed points, my choice of integration constants. If I want to talk about a Bayer action, it's something I've solved for in the vicinity of the fixed point. Contrast this to this case here, of a non-renormalized trajectory, I just choose some Bayer action, which in this case, oops, is perhaps what one more intuitively understands by a Bayer action, and I just solve the effective action at the effective scales. So the next question is, how much do the relevant corrections actually tell us? So along a renormalizable trajectory, as I've mentioned a number of times, you can write the action in a self-similar form. So all scale dependence occurs through the couplings in the anomalous dimension. And make no mistake, this is a really profound statement. You know, that in the whole space of interactions, some, in principle, incredibly complicated theory, all the scale dependence occurs through only a very small number of parameters. But this is sometimes taken to mean more than it does. And it doesn't mean that, for example, scalar field theory in three dimensions doesn't develop 5 to 6 terms, 5 to 8 interactions, etc., as you flow out along this. All it means is that these couplings have their scale dependence coming through these guys. So working out the exact scale dependence of the action is a non-perturbative problem. And so I think it's useful to just separate out what the perturbative considerations are in this game and what the non-perturbative ones are. So the perturbative things, if you look at the Gaussian fixed point, and you want to classify whether your operators are relevant, irrelevant, marginal, and so forth, this is a purely perturbative question in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point. If you want to compute the approximate scale dependence to extremely high precision in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point, again, you can do this using perturbation theory. What about the non-perturbative questions? Well, determining the existence of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, at least in three dimensions, is an intrinsically non-perturbative question. And if you want to compute, rather than the approximate scale dependence, the exact scale dependence, even in the vicinity of the weakly coupled Gaussian fixed point, this is itself a non-perturbative question. And the fact that renormalized trajectories correspond to renormalizable theories, again, as I've emphasized throughout the talk, is an intrinsically non-perturbative question. So finally, I started off with statistical physics, and I then I've been talking mostly about quantum field theory. And as a final thing, I'd just like to come back to statistical physics and to mention what the difference is between the critical point and the fixed point. So if we consider a fixed point with n relevant directions, and as I mentioned, card is a nice way of putting things. If you're an experimentalist, you've got n dials, n knobs that you want to tune. So in the case of a ferromagnet, you want to adjust the temperature very precisely, and you want to adjust the magnetic field to zero, as it turns out. And this will get you onto the critical surface. So there we go. Now, what tuning these knobs does is this moves us around in parameter space. And the point where this trajectory, as I change my various parameters, intersects the critical surface is the critical point of a particular model. So I'll illustrate this in a second. And universality comes in because under ERG transformations, different critical points flow into the same fixed point. So here we go. So here's some model. So this might be a model of a ferromagnet. Might be the Ising model at some temperature and some value of magnetic field. As I change these parameters, I flow along this line here. At the point where I adjust the parameters just right, I hit the critical surface. And once I'm on the critical surface, then under renormalization, I flow into the fixed point here. So one can imagine that over here somewhere, I've got some microscopic model, let's say up here, of water near the liquid vapor transition. Again, I've got some parameters, some knobs I can adjust. When I get it just right, I'm on the critical surface, and then again, it flows towards the fixed point so that the infrared behavior of these two different systems is universal. So just to recap then what I've been talking about. So the exact RG relates physics at different scales via a coarse graining procedure. As we do this procedure of integrating out degrees of freedom and rescaling, the effective action evolves. If we include a rescaling step in this, as well as blocking with rescale, then what we can do is find fixed points, which are intimately related to critical behavior from the statistical mechanics point of view. And they define the simplest renormalizable theories, being as they are scale invariant. If we linearize the ERG equation, we can define scaling fields which are relevant, irrelevant, or marginal. So there's these other redundant ones which I'll come back to in the third lecture. And we can use the relevant directions to construct scale-dependent continuum limits. So these trajectories, which are emanating from these fixed points, renormalized trajectories are self-similar. And this whole picture here allows us to understand intuitively, I think, what it is for quantum field theory to be renormalizable in a full non-perturbative sense. So thank you very much.
Something that I don't understand is that the critical manifold, how can we be sure that it's mathematically manifold? So for example, if it isn't the intersection of two hyperspaces.
Right, so I would say yes, that the rigorous mathematical foundation of this aren't that strong. I wouldn't be able to answer off the top of my head whether it is a manifold that demonstrates the mathematics. So I'm afraid I don't know better than that. But it does provide a compelling and experimentally very well verified picture of how these various systems are behaving.
So can you show again the characteristic of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point?
Sure. Which bit exactly was it?
The previous slide.
Ah, yeah. So this is a non-trivial fixed point which exists in less than four dimensions.
For which, what are the operators which are relevant or marginal?
Well, so in three dimensions, this is something you really need to determine numerically. If you want to find the Wilson-Fisher fixed point in three dimensions, you've got no small parameter. If you're working four minus epsilon, you've got a small parameter. If you're working in three dimensions, you've got no small parameter. You've got your exact normalization group equation, which is a nonlinear integrated differential equation with variation of derivative.
You can linearize around this point. No? Can't you linearize around this point?
But you've got to find it first.
Okay.
And the only known way to find it is numerically.
So you know it only numerically, so the linearization around it is not analytical. And
right, but if you want to work in 4 minus epsilon dimensions and 2 minus 5 dimensions, you can use Wilson's epsilon expansion. Mm-hmm. Whenever you've got a small parameter to hand, then you can do things analytically. But if you want to answer questions like this, where there is no small parameter, then generically the best you can do is numerically. Again, this is actually something I'll discuss in detail in the third lecture.
And perturbatively, in 3D, the scalar theory also has the same ambiguities that you were saying it has in 4D?
Perturbatively, I would have thought so.
So did this statement that the theory is non-perturbative, renormalizable, and also non-trivial, goes along with a statement that is also perturbatively
renormalizable? No, the existence of a non-perturbative renormalizable theory, this comes down to simply the question, are there non-trivial relevant directions? So, if there are, then let me just go back here. If there are, then you can show that the action is self-similar, non-perturbative. Right?
Basically means that higher order loops are just going to generate
operators
of the same type.
Let me just finish what I was saying. So once you found if there's non-trivial relevant directions, you can show that the action is self-similar. So this argument that I went through here, this was non-perturbative in essence. Now let's suppose you actually want to do a calculation and you use perturbation theory. That's then a different matter as to whether you find a renormal ambiguity there or not. That's a different matter from the non-perturbative question of renormalizability. The point that the renormal ambiguity comes up in D=4 is because, as I was saying over here, when you write down perturbation theory, and you've got these lambda over lambda zero terms, if you can get rid of this, then you have something which is self-similar. So what we're doing is essentially we're identifying self-similar trajectories with ones which are non-perturbatively renormalizable. So if you can get rid of this, then you have a non-perturbatively renormalizable theory. The question is, why can't you do this? And the reason is that this limit doesn't exist. But this is a different matter from whether you've got non-trivial relevant directions in the first place.
So what I mean is that you do the audio writings when the theory is not super renormalized. Yes, indeed, in D when E was 3, the Bipolar theory is super renormalized.
Sure, yes. So when you've got a marginal term, it's not necessary, well, it's not. Sorry, phrasing this. Not necessarily. I mean, if you're in the vicinity of this fixed point, you could be coming in along a completely different direction here. And you could ask the same question, is this thing renormalizable? Right? So let's suppose that you're coming in along a 5-6 direction. You could say, is this renormalizable? You'd immediately find that it isn't. Right? If you came in instead along this direction, which happens to be the marginal one, then you find that perturbatively at any rate, it seems to be renormalizable. Right, so there's nothing to stop you looking at non-marginal directions along here. I mean, I think the confusion comes about because if you want to talk about renormalizable theory, really the only way to do it in the strict sense, in terms of fixed points, and ask the question whether there's non-trivial renormalized trajectories emanating from them. The whole question of terms of renormalizability applied before is sort of done with that picture completely removed. So when you bring that picture back in, you start to find apparent contradictions. It's only when you dig it a bit deeper you're able to resolve them. But if you knew this picture from the start, you'd say, well, lambda 5-4 is not renormalizable. Full stop. The question of perturbative renormalizability is, you know, when you look at the renormalizability of 5-4 in textbooks, you will very rarely, perhaps almost never, see any mention whatsoever of RG fixed points, which is really the thing which is underlying whether there is renormalizability or not. So that just never enters the discussion, whereas it should. So you then take those items in, you start to get apparent contradictions because of the starting point.
The concept of the scheme in renormalization, mm-hmm. for example, sometimes we say it's scheme.
Yes.
So how does it come into play? Is it related to
freedom? It's exactly that. So each time you make a choice of your bottle function, you choose a different renormalization group, and each one implicitly defines its own scheme. So you've got the renormalization group itself, then you choose your renormalization conditions, and together, that will define a scheme. The scheme will be different for each renormalization group. And will be different from MS or MS bar or whatever. Thanks for those of you who are still left.